Hi there, Jeb Sharp here with How We Got Here, number 61. How We Got Here is a history podcast from PRI's The World. The World is a public radio program co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. Another week, another revolution. Well, not quite, but events are moving so quickly it almost feels that way. I'm going to stay on Egypt, even though attention is moving quickly to other places. All your questions are still relevant, and there's obviously much still to come there. Some of you wanted to know what the changes in Egypt might mean for women. Who knows? As one of my sources told me, none of us has the crystal ball. But we can at least talk about the role women took in the protests and what they're saying and thinking about the future. And historian Mona Russell will help us think about the status of women in Egypt over the past 100 years or so. First, let's listen to this radio piece from Ursula Lindsay. It's called The Women of Tahrir Square, and it aired on The World on February 10th.
Ruheya is a 21-year-old university student. She's come to Tahrir Square from the town of Sharqiyya, about 100 miles north of Cairo. Today she's one of the volunteers monitoring the entrance to the square, checking IDs and searching bags to make sure no one brings in weapons. She steps forward eagerly to speak with me and launches into an attack on President Hosni Mubarak. Ruheya wears a long conservative veil. She's been involved in protests on her university campus led by Islamist groups. But she's never participated in something like this. And she says it's bigger than any religious or political affiliation.
There are Christian girls here. There are girls with their hair uncovered. We're all volunteers. We're all Egyptians, whether we're Christians or Muslims, whether we're religious or not. We're all good people. We're all sacrificing for our country.
Many of those sacrificing are women, which may come as a surprise to many, but really shouldn't, says history professor Mona Russell.
Well, certainly in contemporary times, women were at the forefront of the 1919 revolution in Egypt, right before Egypt got its independence, the independence struggle against the British. Women were prominent even at the time of the French occupation as well. So Egyptian women have been involved in protests for many, many years. This isn't something new.
But the authoritarian governments that have governed Egypt for the last 60 years have curtailed the autonomy of women's organizations, just as they have tightly controlled all freedoms of assembly and expression. Women, like most Egyptians, have been frightened away from politics. But because of the scope and significance of the last few weeks, women were determined to be involved. Asmat Mahfouz is a young activist who posted YouTube videos of herself calling on Egyptians to participate.
Everyone in the country who considers himself a man should go out. Everyone who says girls shouldn't go to demonstrations because they'll be abused should act like a man and go out himself. To everyone who says not enough people will protest, nothing will come of it, I say it's your fault.
Women make up more than half of Egypt's university students. They're visible in the media and on the street. Many work. But women rarely get the top posts in government or business. A woman's highest ambition is still expected to be to establish a family. Khulud Saber is a human rights activist. She's been going to the protests every day since they started. I met her in the busy offices of the NGO where she works. She says the protests have reaffirmed a spirit of freedom and solidarity that has given women new breathing room.
I found a lot of teenagers, girls, and even old women and that are veiled and from the really middle class who are clearly not involved before in such things. But the thing that surprised me is that how I behave as a woman in the demonstration. I smoke and I kiss my friends in the street.
This is behavior that in normal times might have attracted unwanted attention or criticism. Nowadays, Saber says, nobody even notices.
During the demonstration, I couldn't, even for a single time, I didn't face any kind of harassment or any kind of even that someone looking to you in a strange way. And I stayed to very late at the street to 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. and it was totally safe and totally also relaxing. It's not only safe, And all the personal orientations related to religion and gender and ethnicity just disappeared.
Women have long been told, by the government and even by opposition groups here, that their rights are a priority, but that economic reforms or security concerns or cultural considerations must come first. But as they've so fully participated in the first mass protest movement in Egypt in a generation, women here have found that they don't need to wait for anyone's permission to be full citizens. For The World, Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
Thanks for taking us there, Ursula. As you heard in Ursula's piece, women protesters are not a new phenomenon in Egypt. In this podcast, we're going to hear a bit more from historian Mona Russell. She teaches at East Carolina University. She's the author of the book Creating the New Egyptian Woman, which looks at women in late 19th century and early 20th century Egypt. Here she is with a few more specifics about what women were doing in those protests against British rule back in 1919.
They organized protests, they organized boycotts against British goods and services.
In 1919, was there a reason in particular that it was the women organizing the protests?
Well, one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, was that many of the men were arrested, and so it was their wives that were sort of left with the mantle of organization. But it was also the wives of the people who were politicians and leaders who also organized their own protests.
Not only were women playing active roles in society back then, they do so today, Mona Russell says. She thinks there's often a misconception outside Egypt that Egyptian women are somehow downtrodden. They're not, she says.
Women are a huge part of Egyptian society. They're not secluded, they're not segregated. They're part as much a part of society as women in American society. They, you know, contribute to the economy, they contribute to the household. They're fully functional in society.
And just in terms of the way we think about women's status, how would it compare to, say, women in America in terms of the right to vote or family law or sex discrimination protection?
All right. Well, in terms of the right to vote, women in Egypt did not get the right to vote until, say, 1956. But, you know, we could also look at, for instance, France. You know, women didn't get the right to vote in France until, you know, shortly after World War II. So it's not as though women in other Western countries, you know, didn't get the right to vote until rather late there either. In terms of being able to, you know, inherit their own property, to in terms of getting credit and all of these sorts of things, and their rights protected by law, that's something that's existed for a very long time. Things like maternity leave that came, you know, with the Egyptian Revolution and those types of laws. So women have a very good position in society. They're knowing about their rights. Sometimes that differs according to class, and knowing how to have access and to, you know, protect their rights, that's sometimes a different story.
What strikes you about what's happening now as regards gender? I mean, because you at least study through a lens of gender, are you thinking about that as you watch what happens next?
Well, what strikes me most about these protests is how little it has to do with gender and how much it has to do with just basic human rights, basic civil rights, and it has very little to do with other things that in Egypt that have been so common. It has very little to do with religion, very little to do with gender. And these are, you know, this is departs from the past, because in the past, you know, there have been huge sectarian issues. In the past, you know, gender has been a major issue. And right now, I'm seeing very little of this.
I remember when I was in college being in a women's studies class where we read Nawal el-Saadawi, and I think she's still alive and still
she
is. Still
she's
activist.
Been her, she's 80 years old.
And what were her issues? What have been her issues?
So I actually studied with Nawal el-Saadawi in the spring of 1992 when I was doing a language study program in Egypt. She taught a women's studies course for the language program that I was studying with. And kind of her basic belief system is that, you know, we're under sort of a patriarchy where, you know, our God, our state, and our husband are lording over us, and that we need to kind of overcome this triangular patriarchy. And that's her belief system in a nutshell, and that we need to overcome that patriarchy. And right now, I guess she would say it's this, the problem is the state that is overpowering the women of Egypt. And she has been out on the streets with the demonstrators every day. I've seen her complaining about the Mubarak sending thugs out in the streets, paying them with 50 pounds and a chicken. And she also, as a matter of fact, happened to go to high school with my mother, and my mother even remembers her being out in demonstrations against the British in the 1940s, against King Farouk and the British in the 1940s. So this is many, many years that this woman has been actively protesting for change.
Amazing. Now, I mean, this is such a long time ago, but my memory is that one of her issues is about the veil. Is that a debate about women or a debate about religion or both? And is it still relevant in Egypt?
Well, I would say that most adult Muslim women do wear the veil or some form of headscarf. And she, of course, would be, you know, she is of the, and there are many Muslim women that are of the interpretation that one does not necessarily have to wear one. But that is, she, I would say she's on a very sort of leftist fringe of interpretation. And I would say that most women in Egypt would find her interpretation much more radical than they're willing to accept. In fact, she has a much greater following and popularity outside of Egypt than inside of Egypt.
And in Egypt, is it a kind of...
In fact, when I was taking a class with her, she was under house arrest, and we would have to go to her apartment and study because the government was afraid that Islamists were going to assassinate her, and they were keeping her under house arrest so she wouldn't go out and be assassinated.
Wow, because she was speaking out so strongly against the wearing of the veil.
Well, she was just speaking out strongly on all kinds of issues that would cause trouble.
So in terms of veils or headscarves, is it a kind of live and let live philosophy among most people, would you say?
Again, there is a wide range of beliefs. I mean, there are people who are live and let live on the subject. There's other people who would like to see it imposed on people. The Sheikh Al-Azhar, who recently passed away, Tantawi, he was a little bit more flexible on things. He had told girls who lived in France that they, you know, didn't need to wear it, you know, so that it wouldn't cause problems. And in fact, he was very much against the kind of veil that covered the face. When he went and visited a school in Egypt and found a girl wearing it, he actually ripped it off of her head. And this created a big stir, you know, amongst people who felt that it wasn't his place to do that. And other people felt it was his place to kind of dictate terms. And so it caused a huge controversy.
And while we're talking about gender, I think for sure there's this idea that the Muslim Brotherhood are Islamists, that if there's a transition, they may gain more power, and that may mean trouble for women. What do you say to that concern?
Well, first of all, none of us has the crystal ball out, and we really don't know what will happen. The population as a whole is not, you know, well enfranchised. It's estimated that maybe 40 or 50% of the population is registered to vote. You know, there has to be major constitutional change. People need to register to vote, and we don't know what will happen if and when people register to vote. So I think that when people, you know, register to vote, when people raise their voice, when people put into power the people that they think represent their interests, that, you know, they'll get the kind of government that they want. And, you know, if women represent 50% of the country, then you know, they're not going to put in place something that's going to be detrimental to their interests. If initially it is, then they'll rally for change. There are institutions in place to rally for change. Honestly, people don't know what will happen, and the Muslim Brotherhood already exists in the government. I mean, because they are a religious party, they can't actually, you know, call themselves a party as it exists in the government now. But they run as independent candidates, and they are the opposition party, the largest bloc of opposition in the government. So they already exist in the establishment, and, you know, they are already a party to talks, you know, in parliament and so on. So they already exist. It's not as though they're not already there. They're a party to everything that happens. So they're the moderates, one might say. Even within the Muslim Brotherhood, there's a wide range of individuals. A lot of the people are people that have modified their stance so that they could get into the government. And many times they, especially on their English language website, will, you know, modify their position to sort of meet the public and consumer demand, and they might say something else, you know, in private. So that's another issue. And, you know, there's a spectrum of beliefs within the Brotherhood. So that's yet another sort of layer to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Anything else that you're really interested in, or you want people to know, or that struck you in the last 2 weeks?
Well, I would say one of the sort of little video clips that has been shooting around the internet is that many people have perhaps already seen is of a young, you know, in her 20s girl that is encouraging the people to go out and protest. And as I said, it's one of those sort of YouTube clips that's gone viral. As to whether she really is the person that started all of the protests, I don't know whether one can give her all of the credit for this, but certainly I would say she's representative of the type of kind of enthusiasm that was going on during the period before the protests started, where people had seen what was going on in Tunisia and got on the internet and, you know, were trying to get their friends out to go and protest. So this clip of this girl in her 20s, as I said, has gone really viral on the internet. And it's really got some very gendered messages, because she says, you know, I'm just, you know, one girl, you know, you've got to go out, you know, and go out, be a man, you know, go out. She uses messages of honor and so on to almost, you know, shame people. Bring a friend, tell your friends, go out and do it.
So what does she symbolize to you?
She symbolizes the voice of the Egyptian woman encouraging the citizen to go out and really the Egyptian men to go out and be a man and, you know, protect your nation. She said, you know, I'm willing to do it, but you have to go out and do it too and tell your friends and tell them to do it.
And finally, Mona, if you're comfortable with this, it sounds like you have background in Egypt and your mother was there. Were you born there, or did you come? Just anything you can tell us about just what it's like personally to watch this unfolding.
It's absolutely spectacular and moving. My mother came to the United States in 1956 to get her master's and PhD and ended up staying here. And we have lots of family back home. And to me, it's very moving to watch these pictures and demonstrations of people in the streets. It's unbelievable. And, you know, even for my friends and colleagues in Middle East studies who've just, you know, spent years studying the country, who aren't even Egyptian, they're moved to tears as well.
And there you have it. Hard for anyone not to be swept up by the seeming enormity of what's happened so quickly in Egypt this month. Again, that's Mona Russell, professor of history at East Carolina University, author of the book Creating the New Egyptian Woman. I'll post a link to her book and her blog and that video she mentions at our webpage, theworld.org/history. That's theworld, one word, .org/history. history. Also, just to avoid confusion, that interview with Mona Russell was recorded on Wednesday, February 9th, so that's still 2 days before Mubarak resigned. The time references get a little difficult right now at the speed with which events are moving. Before I leave you today, I want to share one more item from the world. To try to understand what's been happening in Egypt and the region, we've been looking for historical parallels and analogies. And some commentators have compared the unrest in North Africa and the Middle East to the upheaval that swept through Europe in 1848. Historian Mike Rapport of the University of Stirling in Scotland spoke with the world's Lisa Mullins.
In 1848, there was a wave of uprisings across Europe, really reaching from Paris to Krakow and from north to south. And it toppled a series of authoritarian or conservative governments. And it brought reformists and liberals to power, and they tried to establish constitutional rule where it didn't exist, and civil rights, and in some cases to try to free their own countries from foreign rule.
We should say that many of these regimes had only been around for 30 years or so, kind of parallel to what's happening right now in parts of the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's true that the regimes which were toppled in 1848 equally had only been around for just over 30 years. They had been established in many cases in 1815 in the wake of the downfall of Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, this isn't true of all of them, but it was certainly true of some of the more notable ones.
Okay. Now, one interesting point here. There was a piece of information technology, not Facebook, that played a role in the spreading of the news then. What was it?
It was the telegraph, which allowed a lot of the news to spread very rapidly from one city to the next. And so the telegraph was actually in many ways responsible for the crisis of confidence which many of these regimes had in facing down the opposition when the revolutionary moment came, because the news traveled so fast and people learned about it quickly as well, and it allowed people to respond to the news of revolutions in other countries very, very quickly. It explains partly why 1848 spread so rapidly. But there was also the steamship. There was also the railway line. In fact, I think maybe the railway is perhaps even more important than the telegraph because it was a much wider network.
So tell us how that worked. Maybe give us a bit of the geography and how the news spread from one regime to another through steamship, railway, and telegraph.
Well, yes. I mean, the epicenters of the revolts in Europe at that time were probably, I mean, definitely Paris, but probably you can also add to that Vienna. But the first revolutions of that year actually took place in Sicily and Naples in southern Italy. And one of the reasons the revolution which began in Palermo spread to Naples in southern Italy was because the news reached Naples via paddle steamer, which I thought was always like a nice little modern touch. It makes the revolutions have a very strongly modern feel about them. And when you compare it to, say, the first big revolution in Europe, the great French Revolution of 1789, where it took 2 weeks for the news to spread of the fall of the Bastille in Paris to northern Italy and a little bit less into Germany, the speed of the news was quite a dramatic change.
And what was the news?
The main one, the really kind of earth-shattering news, was that there was a revolution in Paris. Paris had a revolutionary tradition. People looked to Paris. And so when that happened, when Paris rose up in revolution, a lot of people followed. And the revolutions didn't come out of the blue. I mean, there was a lot of opposition. There was a major economic crisis, of course. I mean, a global or at least a European-wide economic crisis, which, of course, has parallels with today in the Middle East. And so there's a great deal of discontent. A lot of people were frustrated with the limitations of the freedoms they were given by the conservative order. Again, a modern parallel there. And in the end, once you get a revolution in Paris, when people go, right, Paris is rising up, they follow the French example and rise up. In Vienna as well. Vienna is in many ways the epicenter. Vienna, the uprising in Vienna, sparks insurrections in the Austrian-ruled parts of Europe, such as northern Italy.
Well, what were people's lives like then? What kind of revolution were they calling for and why?
Now, there were two types, really. There were the liberals, the moderates, if you like, many of them middle class or aristocratic, who simply wanted political change with civil rights. Not necessarily even democracy, but say a constitutional monarchy with limited parliamentary government. But you also had radicals who wanted radical social reform, a reorganization of labor relations, for example. And in many cases, in parts of Central Europe, remember, serfdom still existed, or a form of servitude for the peasants still existed. They wanted to abolish that. And on that, the moderates agreed. But they certainly didn't want to push the revolution towards, say, a socialist or social democratic type of regime, which the radicals wanted. And here again, one could argue that there are parallels. On the streets of Cairo, we saw secular middle-class students and professionals out on the streets. But then more recently, you've seen more radical Islamic militants coming out as well and joining the protests too. And there's the potential for a great deal of tension between the two wings of the opposition there. And that's exactly what happened in 1848.
These are some of the similarities. What are some of the differences?
Well, one of the differences I hope we see is the international context. I mean, in the end, one of the big differences I hope emerges is that you don't get bloodshed, civil war in these countries. That hasn't happened yet. And it's partly because one of the differences is the response of the authorities.
And you're saying that there was massive bloodshed back in 1848.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. First of all, in the initial wave of revolutions in Paris, in Berlin, in Vienna, in Milan. But it's partly because in those cities, the authorities tried, less so in Vienna, but they tried to crush the insurrection using lethal force. And here, of course, the big difference between what's going on there and in Cairo now is that the army seemed to be playing some kind of waiting game or indeed might be wondering whether they should side with the demonstrators and so have been restrained. I mean, people have been killed, but they have not been deployed in the kind of overwhelming, crushing force which the conservative order tried to do in 1848 in many cities in Europe.
It's interesting to note that most of the 1848 revolutions failed throughout Europe, but mm-hmm. would you say that they had a lasting legacy?
I think they did. I mean, first of all, serfdom was abolished in Central and Eastern Europe where it had existed, and that prepared the way for a lot of peasants to become fully-fledged citizens of modern nation states. The second thing is that some states, although the revolutions are crushed, do emerge and remain as constitutional monarchies. And these become the nucleus, the kernels of the United States of Germany and of Italy later on in the 19th century. And what's more, in France, for example, 1848 introduces universal male suffrage on an almost permanent basis. Another legacy, the people in general enter politics on a scale unprecedented, and the peasantry as well. I mean, some peasants in some countries actually get elected to parliament. Which is unprecedented in European history. But this is what happens.
Mike Rapport is senior lecturer in history at the University of Stirling in Scotland, author of the book 1848, Year of Revolution.
Thank you, Lisa. That's Lisa Mullins of The World. That interview aired on The World on February 9th, 2011. The World radio show and its associated podcasts, including this one, are co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can find us online at theworld.org. The page for how we got here is at theworld.org/history. And again, I will post a few links there, including one to Mike Rapport's book about 1848. You can also post your comments and questions there, or you can post them at the How We Got Here Facebook group page if you prefer. You can also email How We Got Here. The address is howwegothere@gmail.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. The address is @JebSharp, all one word. I love hearing from you. Huge thanks also to those of you who've been writing iTunes reviews. It's incredibly heartening to see you reflecting back exactly what I'm trying to accomplish here. So thanks for writing those. Thanks for listening. Please stay in touch. I'm Jeb Sharp in Boston.